The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
First, we're almost there. Tomorrow is polling day. It's time for the final leader's pitch. Fine Gael have been in power since 2011, first under Enda Kenny, then Leo Varadkar, and now with Simon Harris, who was first elected to the Dáil in that 2011 election. Mr. Harris has only known life on the government benches, and he hopes to keep it that way after tomorrow. So to go through some of their plans for another term in government, Taoiseach and Fine Gael leader Simon Harris joins us in studio. Taoiseach, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, looking at the polls, there is a trend that you've been seeing in the last three polls that Fine Gael losing support. What do you put that down to?
Well, being very honest, a couple of things, and I feel really good about tomorrow. I feel very hopeful about tomorrow that people will lend us their vote so that I can continue on my job as Taoiseach and so that we can really put together a stable government for the next 5 years. But I think a couple of things. Firstly, when an election is called, as you know from following elections for many a year, the polls always reset. I think Irish people think about their vote very carefully. They think it through. They want to put politicians through their paces. I think the second fact is I've also had to regenerate and rejuvenate my party in real time, introduce a lot of new candidates to the people right across the country, people who are new to politics, but certainly not new to delivering in their area. And I think what's happening now, and you saw it in last night's poll, when a ballot paper was put in front of people in the Red Sea poll, and my party came joint first on 21 apiece for Fine Gael, 21 apiece for Fianna Fáil. This is a very, very close election. And that's why right through today and right through tomorrow, up till 10 o'clock tomorrow night, yeah, I'll be asking for every possible vote for Fine Gael.
But you were emphatic in the late summer, early autumn that you would go the full term of this government right into 2025, late February, early March. And I was speculating at the time that the reason was that you had a whole raft of new candidates. You'd lost some of your very high profile people. They had decided to opt out of politics. And therefore, the extra time over the Christmas period and so on, some of your candidates would get to know their electorate in a way they perhaps hadn't. Now you've been gazumped really by people like Ivan Yates and indeed your colleague, Roderick O'Gorman in government, who decided the election was going to be on the 29th of...
Well, I have great respect for Ivan Yates, but I think not even he can claim he picked the date of the election. But let me say this.
He was saying it's madness to go in February.
Sure.
Leo Varadkar had a bad experience in February and he went on and on. And it almost was like you were being coerced moving from February to November.
No, I mean, truthfully, I had to weigh this up. You'll remember when I became leader of Fine Gael only 7 or 8 months ago, a lot of people said, oh, he's going to try pull a stunt here. He'll call a snap election and try and, you know, get out there ahead. And I chose not to do that because I chose to do the responsible thing. I said, we have to get another budget passed. We have to help people with the cost of living. We have to help businesses. We have to help farmers. We have to help lower the costs for families. So my priority was to get that budget through, the fifth budget of this government, to work with the other political parties, to be respectful to them in how we govern. Then we got to a point where we were getting into nearly this kind of pedantic debate about what is full term. And my view was this, and my view today is still this. Once the government passed that fifth budget, I think there was a safe and appropriate time for Ireland to have a general election. People will vote tomorrow. That will then provide a period of time for the politicians to deal with the outcome of that election and try and form a government and have a new government in office ready to hit the ground running. Because what I can definitely tell you is this, Pat, what we don't need after the next general election, the people are sovereign, but what we don't need here is months and months and months of navel-gazing. The country needs a government that can get on with the job.
But don't we have to form the government that the people throw at us?
Absolutely.
That's it, you know?
Oh, 100% right. And that's why I suppose I'm asking people when they vote tomorrow, of course I'm asking them to vote Fine Gael, but I'm also asking them to keep at the back of their mind how we try to put together a government after this election as well, because that is really important. There's real issues carrying on in real time here, including the issue of preparing for a Trump presidency.
I mean, I suppose the cynics would say you saw Sinn Féin's discomfiture. They had tumbled in the polls from the 30s down to the teens, and it looked like a great moment to eliminate them from contention for leading a government.
The cynics will always be cynical. What I did was, what I outlined there was, I suppose, tried to find the appropriate space after we passed the budget. And I set a number of kind of red lines that I wanted to be met before I would call a general election. Passing the budget, making sure the cost of living package was in place, and also agreeing new housing targets so we could ramp up the scale of our ambition. Once those three things happened, I feel now is the appropriate time for a general election, and that's why people will vote tomorrow.
If what is revealed in the Sunday Business Post poll or the Business Post poll was to be replicated tomorrow, it would mean Fianna Fáil, the largest party. If that were to be the case and you were behind and perhaps Sinn Féin and yourselves there or thereabouts, would you be available to go into a confidence and supply arrangement with Fianna Fáil, leading the government as they did with you?
So firstly, I say it very respectfully, I think that's an over-interpretation of the polls. All of the polls show a three-horse race to come first.
No, but I'm saying that if that was the situation, it's something you've got to contemplate. They did you the favour in Fine Gael in supporting that government with confidence and supply.
Fine Gael is running in this election to lead the next government. I believe it's entirely possible that that can happen. I think what's most likely to happen after the next election is a coalition government. I think that government is likely to probably involve at least three parties. I would think a government that gets beyond three parties becomes harder to manage in terms of a coherent policy base. But I think what the country needs, in my view, is the Taoiseach of this country. I strongly believe we need a stable government with a working Dáil majority.
What I'm interpreting from this, rightly or wrongly, is that it won't be confidence supply. It will have to be maybe Fianna Fáil primus inter pares if they get more seats.
What I'm saying is I want to put together a coalition government. I'd like Fine Gael to lead that government. The strength that Fine Gael has in that government is entirely in the people's hands.
Now, the door-to-door contacts you've been having, I mean, we're hearing reports that people are just not answering the door to politicians. Has that been your experience?
No, not necessarily. I think people's passions have changed, I suppose. A lot of people working from home now, someone ringing a doorbell in the middle of the day, you might get someone at home, but that person might be upstairs on an important work call. So the flows and where you find the electorate, I suppose, has somewhat changed. I'm finding people engaged. I hear a lot of kind of media commentary that it's been a dull campaign or whatever else. What I'm actually finding is for the electorate, it's been a difficult campaign. And I'm being really quite honest in relation to this. I'm meeting people, you know, people who maybe aren't sure who to vote for. There might even be people listening to this programme today, not 100% sure. And people are teasing through the issues. So, you know, on housing, wanting to say, show me, tell me, give me a bit more detail. What hope have you got for my children in the next 5 years? Explain to me how you're going to afford to do what you're committing to do. And asking quite a lot of detailed questions. And I've definitely noticed in the last week, 10 days of the campaign, people becoming very engaged on the issues. And I think that's what's really brought us to this point of having a very close election tomorrow. But it is always winter campaigns, you know, dark nights. It is always harder, I suppose, to find.
Were you shaken by the Canturk encounter?
I was annoyed with myself. I was annoyed with myself because...
No, but did you kind of...
I messed up. And I messed up on an issue that is extraordinarily important to me and my family. You know, the issue of disability is... There isn't a more important issue based on my lived experience. And I know I messed up. But you know what? I was reared, Pat, that when you make a mistake, you put your hands up, you apologise. And I hope the good thing that's
It's not common in politics that people say they're wrong.
No.
But at the same time, it can, you say you're wrong, and it may lead to a sense of vulnerability that people will seize upon.
Well, look, my political opponents can seize on whatever they like. I think the people of Ireland, I certainly hope, know me. I think they know me for the leadership I provided through the COVID pandemic. I think they've seen the role that I played as Taoiseach. I hope they know how hard I work. And I think a lot of them know my own story in terms of personally getting involved because of the lived experience that I have in my own family with my brother having autism. I think people want to see when you hit a vulnerable patch, when you make a mistake, when you err, how you respond to that. And I've tried to respond honestly, no spin, no whataboutery, no justification, just saying that was my mess up. I own it. I'm sorry.
Now, we'll move on to housing. You talk about housing and people asking you, you know, are my kids going to be able to afford to buy a house or even rent a dwelling of some kind? When you look at the stats, I mean, rents have gone up. From 2011, 825 was the measure per month. Third quarter of 2024, 1,955, more than doubling in that 13-year period. You can look at the same house prices. In 2011, 212 would buy that typical three-bed semi. In the third quarter of 2024, 344,000, gone up by, what, 67% or whatever. Why would people believe you that you can contain this housing crisis?
Very fair question. But I think the reason I'm asking people to believe us and vote for Fine Gael tomorrow is because the people of Ireland understand that the last 14 years haven't been static. They understand that in many ways, Fine Gael's time in office has been dogged by a number of major issues that had to be addressed. The IMF bailout, the crash, no construction sector, no banking sector. That was the first part. Then Brexit, then COVID, then an inflationary crisis. And against that backdrop, we've gone from a situation of building fewer than 7,000 homes a year to up towards 40,000 this year. And now, crucially, Fine Gael has something that rarely this country has, money and a plan at the same time. We have a 40 billion euro plan to deliver 303,000 new homes. And you know what? You asked a very direct question there. You read out the headline figures, as you quite rightly should. They're factual. But people around the country know that those headline figures aren't the reality for everybody now, because we have a Help to Buy scheme where 50,000 young people so far have benefited from getting 30,000 off that towards the cost of the house. Mm. We have a First Home scheme where we take a share in the house as well. So there are supports in place.
Okay, but the London School of Economics, looking at the experience of those kind of schemes in the UK, said that they stoke inflation in house prices.
And I don't profess that these schemes are perfect, but I would say two things. When the Central Bank of Ireland looked at it in the Irish context, they found that now would be the wrong time to remove these supports. The second thing is, even if there is a small inflationary element, and that hasn't been proven, but even if there is, the scale of the intervention in terms of assisting the first-time buyer exceeds that. Yeah. What we have to do is bridge the gap from here to proper supply. And I can't say to a first-time buyer living in the box room of their mum or dad's house, come back to us in 5 years when we have enough homes to lower the prices. We have to help them in the here and now. And that's why we're unapologetic in keeping in place these first-time buyer schemes.
The box room dweller is one of the cliches of this election, I have to say. And I don't know anyone with a box room. A small bedroom, perhaps, but a box room.
Let's call it that. But I think you take the point. It's the young person living at home who no longer feels that young, who doesn't want to be sitting down in the sitting room with their parents.
I understand that. I mean, it's awkward for everybody, particularly trying to maybe have a romantic life as well. And in the company of your parents, not easy. The question of Help to Buy and those other schemes, in my experience over the years, looking at the various schemes that governments have introduced, like Section 23 and Section 27, they might work at the beginning and then the builders take it all. They always take advantage of state incentives and the prices go up and it goes into the builder's back pocket.
Well, that's why I suppose in many ways we've resisted doing some things that people have asked us to do. So we haven't extended the price level to which you can use the Help to Buy scheme. And we've been asked to do it, but we haven't, because that would have a very significant inflationary cost on house prices. We're also putting a time limit on this. These are schemes that will be in place for 5 years and then we'll go. But what we're doing with that period of time is getting the number of houses up from nearly 40,000 to 60 and keeping it at that. Because if we can, and we've lots of expert advice on this, if we can get to 60,000 homes a year and keep it there, we will fix the housing crisis. What we won't do, though, is if we have a situation now where people pull the rug from the first-time buyers, you'll make life harder for young people in this country, and we can't do that.
Now, moving on to health, can you fix the health service? I mean, we know that once you're through the gates that you tend to get very good care, but there are people waiting a long time even for cancer treatments, which you'd think that's the one area. I think Michael Noonan made cancer his priority. You'd think that was sorted, but it's not sorted. So the HSE was started in, 2005? We still don't have 7-day working weeks in the HSE. After all that time, more and more money, billions pumped in every year, and we don't seem to be getting the result. We put the money in, we don't get the product.
So two things I'd say on that. Firstly, and you, in fairness, you've acknowledged it, there are signs of progress in lots of parts of health. So survival rates for many illnesses have gone up. Life expectancy in Ireland is higher than the EU average. Waiting times are still too long, but they are falling.
They've fallen A&E, 10 hours, 12 hours.
But just to make the point, they are falling, and they have fallen for the last 2 years when they've risen in Northern Ireland, risen in England, risen in Scotland, risen in Wales, and risen in most of Europe. But I think your point about reform is the key here. I've been a health minister. This idea of having to argue with the Department of Finance every year over the budget doesn't create a conducive environment for reform. That's why Fine Gael are proposing, and I've been adamant about this as Taoiseach, that's why we, if we're re-elected to government tomorrow, we will provide the health service with a multi-annual budget for 5 years, clarity on their funding. Now, why does that matter? It matters because it empowers the people running the health service to plan beyond winter to winter. It allows them with certainty know how many nurses, how many doctors. It allows them have the reform conversation around the GP contract, the pharmacy contract. I think that's a key enabler, and we've seen in other countries where they reformed their health service that multi-annual certainty of funding is absolutely key, and that's what we're going to do.
You have a recruitment section in your manifesto which suggests the recruitment of all sorts of people, and we badly need them. There's no costing of that, and Micheál Martin had a go at you slightly during the debate about that, but he was right, there is no costing. And then you said that it's to be funded from within the allocation. But if you do that, where do you save the money from that goes, if you're going to take it from an existing allocation? What suffers because you're using that money to pay for new staff?
No, I suppose I gently had to go back at him because I think, and I'm sure this was an error rather than an attempt to misinform, but the reality is we've set aside over 17.2 billion euro through what they call existing level of service plus a contingency fund. And that will allow us have the level of additional recruitment into the health service roughly the same as what we've had over the last number of years. But I've got to be honest with your listeners, because your point is right. We've increased the number of people working in the health service by about 27,000. These people are all working hard. We have an ability to do about the same again. But I'm being truthful, I'm being honest. If the conversation is just about numbers and just about budget, it won't bring about the reform. That's why we have to have a new GP contract. It's why we have to support and resource our pharmacists. It's why we have to change the delivery of our therapy services.
But people say, why didn't you do it? Because you were in power, why didn't you do it?
Because it's very simple. In politics, your in-tray, it's not like a job where you go in, you clear the in-tray and you say, job done, Pat. Every day in politics, there's challenges and every day you've got to respond. So much of the last number of years has been dominated by, from a health point of view, responding to COVID and then rebuilding after COVID. And we have, despite that, seen waiting times fall, trolley weights fall, and seen very significant increases in clinical outcomes for our patients.
That trolley weight fall has only dropped, I think, in latter times. I mean, it's been quite high for the bulk of your 5 years.
It has. And as we put in the additional capacity and we've committing to 5,000 more beds, we are beginning to see the benefit of that. So hospitals, give you one example, the hospital in Waterford, which used to have very high trolley numbers, has now seen dramatic improvements. And that's a combination of reform, additional budget, additional staff and additional beds.
Now, you mentioned you were health minister and you were the one who brought the contract for the National Children's Hospital to cabinet and it was signed off by the cabinet. That's collective responsibility. But in your capacity as minister, you must have thrown your eyes over the contract and look at the mess the contract has produced financially.
So I think there are very significant learnings from the Children's Hospital. And that's why, of course, I didn't just do what you said there. As Minister for Health, I also commissioned PwC to independently review the entire situation. And they reported, and that report was published, and they said that to do anything else at that stage would have resulted in the hospital taking longer.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
Taking longer and costing more. I think the bigger question here is this. Why did we go through the entire Celtic Tiger and no one invested in a new children's hospital? We needed this children's hospital. There's people listening
to
this
program. Well, I mean,
that's
a bit disingenuous because, I mean, there was talk of a children's hospital for 20 years prior and we had the site up at the Mater Hospital, which was kiboshed. It was a lunatic idea, but there you go. We then moved to St. James Hospital, which is the wrong place. I mean, the whole philosophy behind this was tri-location. Where is the maternity hospital? Your predecessor, Leo Radker, told me that the planning permission for both would go in at the same time. It didn't happen. And now there is no room for a maternity hospital.
So in many ways, you're making the same point as I'm making, that there was talk about a new National Children's Hospital for many, many years and nobody built one. And there's parents listening to this programme tonight who slept on co-floors in Crumlin and in Temple Street. There are people, nurses and doctors, doing incredible work in those hospitals in inadequate conditions. So many of the issues that we get asked about in terms of children's waiting times for paediatric surgeries and the likes is as a result of an inadequate number of theatres. Sure. So this is an expensive hospital. It is a hospital that costs more than it should, but it will be a revolution in children's healthcare. And can I just say this? There are three parts to this hospital. There's a satellite centre in Talla, a satellite centre in Connolly, and the main hospital.
But the vast work is going to be done in St James, and it's not open yet.
80,000 children have been seen through the two parts that are open. There are children getting treatment today. So this hospital is expensive, but it is an investment in children's healthcare. There's a broader point you're making, though, about the delivery
of infrastructure. The tri-location, first of all, it hasn't happened.
So on tri-location, it is still the National Maternity Strategy to tri-locate to locate maternity hospitals and co-locate them with adult hospitals.
But room in James.
That is still the intention.
The traffic problems that are going to ensue.
And I believe there is still room there. But there's a broader issue in relation to the delivery of infrastructure. Some politicians, in fact, most, are running in this election on that let's continue as we are in terms of the delivery of infrastructure. I'm the only leader proposing establishing a new Department of Infrastructure. Because I can tell you this, we live in a small country, 5.3 million of us in this jurisdiction, and every time we go to deliver mega infrastructure projects, we seem to hit challenges. We need to bring in engineers, project managers, quantity surveyors. And if I'm back as Taoiseach after this election, it'll be a red line issue for me that we establish a Department of Infrastructure to bring in that expertise.
And I think it's really important. A very good idea. I mean, I've been critical all the time that we build the apartments and then we say, where's the shop?
Exactly, we need expertise.
In Spain and Portugal, I've seen that they build the shop first and even put up the street lighting before anything else happens. Now, the other hospital that's going to be built is the new National Maternity Hospital on the site of St. Vincent's Hospital in leafy Dublin 4. Why there? Because there's not exactly a baby boom in Dublin 4. It's not where the babies are being born. They're being born in West Dublin, by and large, in that ring around the city, in the suburbs. Why put it in a place where it's very expensive for staff, to attempt to live, to rent or buy? Is it because it suits the consultants? They like the leafy suburbs of Dublin 4.
No, it's genuinely because it makes sense to co-locate the hospital there from a medical point of view. It makes sense because so many of the... If a woman gets very sick in Holles Street today, and that can still happen, that woman is automatically transferred to St Vincent's Hospital in so many cases. And the length of time that it takes to transfer that woman from the Holles Street to Vincent's can be the difference between a good and a bad outcome. So the co-location of the National Maternity Hospital
there?
Makes
sense. You know, it's Dublin 4, as I say, no baby boom there.
Because it's not the only... We're planning on co-locating all of our maternity hospitals. We're planning on moving away from this standalone approach to maternity hospitals, because thankfully for most people when they go into a maternity hospital it's a time of great joy, but for a time when things go wrong we do need to co-locate. And of course we're also relocating other maternity hospitals, including the one in Limerick, for example.
Now, when you're knocking on the doors, you hear about housing, you hear about health, you also hear about childcare. And a lot of the schemes that all the parties are putting forward are about reducing the cost to the parent. But when you look at what a graduate might earn going into childcare, $15.50 an hour. I mean, it's not a very enticing salary. So how is that problem to be resolved?
No, you're actually right, because so much of the focus in this election debate has been about reducing the cost of childcare. And my party will reduce the cost of childcare to €200 per month per child, and we do it in the next budget. But just let me say but, because that is the easy bit. That will cost about €194 million over the lifetime of the next government. The harder bit is actually the bigger spending plan we have for childcare in our manifesto, which is to both create new places and new staffing levels. And that's going to involve, firstly, many multiples of that amount of money to reduce the cost. Secondly, it's going to involve agreeing a proper pay structure and career structure for people working in childcare.
Now, that means you agree this because there will be state childcare as well. We're told that's
correct.
Part of your
yes, it is.
Vision. It means that there'll have to be parity of pay between the two sectors. So you're telling the private operators you're going to have to jack up your paying conditions to meet what the civil service effectively childcare workers will get.
There will have to be pay parity of that, there's no doubt. But we're not saying to the private provider that you have to pay for it. We're saying the state will work with you and subvent you in relation to that. This is, for me, this isn't an investment in childcare providers or in public childcare. It's an investment in children. And what we need to do is empower parents in the first place to be able to access a place. In the second place, to have choice in relation to the provider they choose. Some parties are proposing all public, getting rid of private. I don't believe in that. I believe in a parent's choice. Many private providers do a good job. But even with supporting private providers more, there's still going to be a need for the state to intervene and provide public facilities. So Fine Gael and government will create 30,000 more childcare places. We will open 100 publicly run childcare facilities, and we will map out in the first 100 days in governments where they should be. And you might say, you'll only map it out now. That work has actually started in the Department of Children. Where in Ireland is the need most acute for public intervention in childcare?
Okay, where are these recruits going to come from? I mean, and where are they going to live? Because the big demand for childcare is obviously in the conurbations.
But they live in Ireland. I mean, I don't mean that smartly.
Where are they going to live when they're living close, hopefully close enough to the places where they work, which will have to be in the conurbations?
But Pat, the amount of doors I've knocked on where there are people who would like to be working more, where people who are working part-time would like to work full-time, where people maybe have decided they need to stay at home and care for their child but would like to work but can't because of childcare costs. There are opportunities in terms of underemployment in the Irish economy. There are lots of people being forced to make decisions due to a lack of childcare. And what I'm saying is, as we improve childcare, we'll actually open up more opportunities for people to enter the workforce. We're also seeing a very healthy pipeline. I know this from my last job in government, of people actually wanting to study, to work in childcare. And I think that pipeline will improve more when you improve terms
okay,
and conditions.
OK, a pipeline into Temple Moor. No matter how full that pipeline is, the capacity of Temple Moor to deliver the guards is limited.
Correct, which is why we need a second Garda College. Now, that's not a lofty thing. We don't need to build a second Garda College. We need to partner with the existing university to provide a second Garda College. Temple Moor is great. We'll invest more in it. But Temple Moor will be full, and that's a really good thing as we ramp up Garda recruitment. We will need a second Garda College. Fine Gael will open a second Garda College. I think that will help with increasing Garda capacity. It'll also help, though, for men and women who want to be guards but may not want to have to trek to Temple Moor to get the training, depending on where they live in the country.
In the same way, what the Garda do, part of their job is to police immigration. 1,100 deportation orders were issued in the first 6 months of this year. Only 65 forced deportation. Now, some people did leave voluntarily, but Padraig Tobin was in here the other day and he said he asked the minister how many people have left the jurisdiction. She said, don't know, can't know because of the border.
Yeah, but Deputy Tobin is often a little bit, you know, flippant in relation to these issues. Let me be really clear. Our approach to migration is changing in this country. Since I've become Taoiseach, I've been very clear that we need to have a firmer system. Migration is a good thing. Immigration is a good thing. Some of the issues we've just discussed, health, childcare, relies on people coming to our
country. Was Leo soft on migration?
No, but the context has changed. I'm very clear from listening to people around the country that Irish people are compassionate, but they do also like an old dose of common sense. They want to know that there are rules, that the rules are applied. They want to know that we're working it with other European countries, that if people have a right to be here, they're told, great, integrated, work, pay your way. If they don't have a right to be here, they get a no, they're asked to leave. If they don't leave, they're deported. These are the sort of systems we have to put in place. So that's why we're significantly improving processing times, and that's very evident now, significantly improving processing times, increasing deportations, but also it's why we're working at an EU level. This idea that Ireland on its own can do this.
Our neighbour, north and across the water, is not in the EU, so
no, but
and that's a porous border.
But unlike in the past, and I'll be careful what I say so as not to wade into British politics, unlike in the past, we now have an interlocutor in Downing Street in Keir Starmer, and I hope an interlocutor in government buildings in Mee, that are willing to work together on these issues about how you protect the common travel area. This idea of British politics using immigration or Northern Ireland for party political gain, those days are gone.
Taoiseach Simon Harris, last day of campaigning. Thank you very much for making time for us on this final day of campaigning, and best of luck with it.
Thank you so much, Pat. Thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.